It is a very happy day today because Rabbi Shmuley Botnick is making his triumphant return to the podcast. It's been a couple of months. I've gotten lots of complaints. Everyone wants Rabbi Botnick back. He's one of the members of the elites because he just recently published his first book and it's getting rave reviews and he's on the top of the bestsellers and he's invited to all these fancy cocktail parties. And he forgot about us, you know, the podcast family that he cut his teeth with, but he's back. The triumphant return of Rabbi Shmuley Botnick to talk to us about Purim, which is in a couple of days. Welcome back, Rabbi Botnick.
Thank you, Rabbi Wolby. I don't know about those cocktail parties. I didn't get the invite. Maybe they went to you.
I don't know about that, but I will tell you that this is not the first time that we're recording on a fast day. I think you said it was last year that we recorded on a fast day.
It was exactly 1 year ago, except minus a few hours, because we made the mistake of doing it late afternoon when our minds were, you know, completely clouded over. So I don't know how well we performed. At this point, I'm doing pretty well, except because we switched the clock. So I managed to eat kind of like a breakfast at 6 in the morning.
Yes, I did the same. I woke up at 5 o'clock, had a nice breakfast, drank a nice coffee, had a nice tall glass of water. So it's a fast day, but I don't feel anything. I feel great. It's 10 a.m. here, Central Time. And it's a fast day, the fast of Esther this year, because Purim really falls out on Shabbos, so it's pushed off to Sunday. Typically, the fast of Esther is the day right before Purim. This year, it's Thursday. Purim's on Sunday, so we still have some time. But let's get rolling. You prepared a masterpiece, I've been told. Most times when we record, you send me your notes, your outline, and this time I have nothing, so I'm completely flying blind, but that's okay. You're going to do the heavy lifting, and I'll serve as I typically do, as you know, the scaffolding. I'm the guardrails. I'm the useful idiot that's just sitting over here and trying to be helpful and trying to listen and learn along the way. And I'm excited. I'm excited to hear what you have to say. So let's begin.
All right, so the good news is that this shouldn't be entirely unfamiliar to you. As you remember last year's year, clearly, at least remember the hunger part of it. We're going to be working with the same theme, but we're going to be taking a very different approach. Last year, what we discussed is something that I'm fascinated by, and that is that the month of Adar, right, as we know, every month correlates to a tribe, right? So there's different ways of looking at that. You know, the most obvious would be you go to the first month is Nisan, and that would correlate with the first tribe, which is Reuven. But that's not how the Arizal works. And the Arizal actually takes a very logical approach, which is that you work with the order of the Golem, the encampments, the four encampments in the desert. So they were set up in a specific order, which was not chronological, right? It didn't go according to their age and stage. God chose it this way, that Yehuda went first, followed by Zvulun, followed by Yisachar. After that, Reuven, Shimon, then Ephraim, so on and so
God.
Forth. So, Reuven, Shimon.
Yes, if you look at the Book of Numbers, you'll see that the arrangement of the camps, and there's four main sections. There's the whole order and the sequencing of how they encamped and how they traveled, and that is the order of the order of the tribes in the system of the months of the Arizal.
That is correct. So according to that system, the very last tribe of all four encampments will be Naphtali. Okay, we don't know all that much about Naphtali. And so, you know, initially that doesn't really mean anything to us. But when you look at the months, the corresponding months, so Adar is obviously the last month of the year. So it's the month of Adar, which is going to share some sort of connection with Naphtali, which just seems striking because, again, Naphtali seems relatively nondescript, doesn't play any significant role in the story of our people, seemingly. And Adar is a very phenomenal month. It has the the holiday of Purim. So how do you see, you know, any sort of relationship between Naphtali and Adar?
So the system of the months is going to start with the month of Nisan, because I guess there's different systems. The year starts on Tishrei, but the first month is Nisan. So if the first month is Nisan, then the 12th month is going to be the month of Adar. So Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul, Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, Tevis, Shvat, and then Adar, which is the month that we're in right now, the month of Purim. And if it's 12 out of 12, it's going to correspond to Naphtali. And we know nothing about Naphtali, or very little about Naphtali, and somehow it is connected with Adar and the primary event, or the centerpiece of Adar, which is Purim.
That's right. And we are going to try and decipher what that is. Now, the truth is that I could find for you almost immediately that some sort of connection, a very vague connection, a very cryptic connection. And that is in Parshas Vezoisa Bracha, where Moshe Rabbeinu gives blessings to all of the tribes. The blessing that he gives, at least part of the blessing he gives to Naphtali, include the words Yam Vidarom Yerusha. Okay, he will inherit the Yam, or it will be is the west.
Yeah, means the sea. So the Mediterranean Sea is west, right?
And then the Darom is the south.
The southwest.
But leaving that aside, the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel, who often, very often, doesn't just translate the words, but he gives some sort of commentary, and frequently that commentary borders on some level of mysticism. So he says these words, V'chadi benune yama. And they will be happy, Naphtali will be happy with the fish of the sea. Wild, pretty wild. I honestly don't know if there's any sort of simple explanation for that. Maybe there is. I would have to research if there's any way to understand this. But when I look at it, to me, it just looks like a completely mysterious blessing that Naphtali will celebrate. He'll be happy with the fish of the sea.
Okay, so at the end of Moshe's life, the end of the Torah, he gives a blessing to every one of the tribes, and he gives a blessing to the tribe of Naphtali, which is the tribe that corresponds to this month. And he says, Yom Vidarom Yerusha, which again, we would translate as Yom is west, Darom is south. He will inherit. He will inherit the southwest, whatever that means. And you're telling me that the Targum Yonasan, the translation of Yonasan ben Uziel, translates those words as not he will inherit the southwest. He instead translates it as he will be happy. He will be delighted in the fish of the sea. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah. Well, kind of. I don't know that he's like substituting the simple translation. Again, it's more of an elucidation than a translation, right? The Targum Yonasan ben Uziel isn't really limited to direct translation. He's meant to be somewhat of a commentator. So I don't know that he's like trying to tell you that this is the translation, but he's inserting this into the text. He's saying that an underlying blessing here is the blessing to celebrate with the fish.
Now, just for clarification, yeah. Targum Yonasan is written by one of the students of Hillel. So this is a very, very, very ancient source. This is a source that precedes the Talmud and precedes the Mishnah, right? It's very, very ancient translation / elucidation of the Torah, and it's very authoritative. So if he's translating these words of Naphtali, and he's telling us that Naphtali will be happy, will be delighted with the fish of the sea, it should get our attention.
Well, and before we try to even understand what it means, what jumps out at me is that this rings very Adar-like, right? For two reasons. The word chadi means happy. That's what it means. It's an Aramaic word for happy. And we know that Adar is the happy month. Mishenichnas Adar marbim b'simcha. Okay. We also know that the Gemara tells us we're taught mazel Adar dogim. Right? The zodiac sign for Adar is fish.
So we have the coalescing of these three things. Naphtali, which is the tribe of the month. And we have joy. This is the month of joy, of ecstasy. When Adar begins, we up the level of joy. And then we have also the sign, the code of the month is fish, and all that is coming together.
Right. So again, without explaining any why, we are seeing the what that Naphtali really does seem connected with at least the themes that are related to Adar. Okay, before we get into all of that, I want to ask another question about Naphtali. That is, I think there's one episode that Naphtali is famous for, and that is when the tribes arrived at the Ma'ar Samachpelah, the cave of the patriarchs, for the sake of burying their father, Yaakov. So we are taught, this is a Gemara in Saita, I would say after Gimel, I think it's page 13a, I think. It's certainly in that neighborhood. And Esav stands there and he tries to prevent them from burying Yaakov, claiming that he owns a portion of it. Now they respond and say, no, you don't own a portion because you sold whatever portion you had, you sold it to Yaakov. And he says, no, I didn't. And they basically, they had the shtar, the document, the proof of sale. They had it, but they left it in Mitzrayim. And so Naphtali was a very, very fast runner. And he ran all the way back to get the bill of sale from Mitzrayim. In the meantime, as we know, Hushim was deaf, the son of Dan. He went ahead and killed Esav, so it really rendered the whole effort unnecessary. But that is what he did, and that's what he's famous for. And not only is he famous for it, but it's actually a part of his blessing, not Moshe, right? There's actually two major blessings to the tribes. One is in Parshas Vayechi, where Yaakov blesses his children. And then later in Parshas Vayeseh Bracha, which we just referenced earlier, where Moshe blesses the tribes. But going back to when Yaakov blesses Naphtali, he says, Naphtali ayala shlucha, hanose nimre shafer. Naphtali, he's ayala is, what's an ayala?
Is it a deer?
No, well, it's a female, right? Ayal is a ram. So it's a female doe? Ram. I guess so. I don't know, every say a female ram.
I'm going to pull out the book. Of course, we should have done this preparation that time. Okay, so this is, I'm in the Torah Center, so I have all the books here. This is chapter 49 of Genesis. Let's see. Naphtali Ayala Shlucha. Naphtali is a hind sent off who delivers beautiful sayings. A hind. What is a hind? I'll Google it. I'm keeping this all on the podcast. I think we did this in the past, by the way. Hind animal. It's a red deer. It's a red deer.
Okay. There you have it. But the point is, Rabbi Wobi, once you have that chumash open, do you want to take a, is there a Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel on that chumash?
1 second, let me find it for you. Let's try to find this right now. I don't have it over here with me.
I mean, you don't necessarily need to. I'll tell you what he says. He just basically reads into those words, and Rashi really does it as well. That it's a reference to this episode, to this Naphtali. His being fast is relevant in the sense that he was able to run back all the way to Mitzrayim and get this bill of sale.
Mm. Which I guess it is interesting that this blessing happened before that event, right?
The blessing happened. Well, that's not so.
Of course,
that's
yes. Not. I agree. With that, yeah.
I mean, that's not so difficult because all of the blessings really alluded to things off into the future. To me, what's more troublesome is like, what's the big deal? Like, this is not really making or breaking it in history. First of all, because it never even panned out. Meaning, we didn't even need it in the end. It was unnecessary. And even if it was important. I mean, we all do important things in life. The idea that Yaakov was blessing his children is with fundamental themes, right? He gives a bracha to Yehuda that your descendants will be kings, and he gives to Reuven. He really rats out Reuven for what he did, but it all goes to very essential parts of their personalities and their destinies. With Naphtali, it seems like, okay, there's going to be once upon a time you're going to run back to Mitzrayim and get this bill of sale. It seems really technical. And I would say not central to who he is and what he represents.
So right? Why is he highlighting the fact that Naphtali is an Olympic sprinter? He's very speedy. Yeah. Why is that so central to his character? And especially because this one event that we know of where he ran back, it actually was not even needed, right? Because right. By the time he, you know, when he was there in the interim, Hushim, the deaf son of Dan, he decapitates Esav, and the bill of sale is not even needed.
Right. Okay. So now let's try to do a deep dive into Naphtali. And to do that, we go back to his genesis, which is obviously when he's born. And so just a little background. Naphtali is born to Bilhah. So again, just to review. So Yaakov, initially, he marries Leah. And then he marries Rachel. Leah has a maidservant, Zilpah, who Yaakov marries, or he takes her as a concubine. Rachel has a maidservant, Bilhah. Also, Yaakov, brings her into the family, so to speak. And what happened was, the story was that Leah was having, child after child, and Rachel was very despondent by the fact that she was not having children. Ultimately, I think it was at this point that she brought Bilhah. Sorry, right? At this point, she introduced Bilhah, and Yaakov, Yaakov had this, I don't know if it was a marriage, but he had this relationship with Bilhah, and she gave birth to a child who Rachel named Naphtali. Okay, so Naphtali is the first of Bilhah's children.
Well, isn't it, doesn't Dan come beforehand? Dan Naphtali?
No, I think it's Naphtali first and then Dan.
No. No.
Oh, no, you're right. So
chapter 30, verse 5, Bilhah has a baby, and she calls him Dan, and then verse 8, she has a second son, Naphtali.
Okay, good. Okay, excellent. Okay, that actually makes more sense. So what does the word Naphtali mean? So she says, Naphtali Elokim Naphtalti. Okay, we're not even going to translate that because we don't know what the translation means, and therefore she called him Naphtali because of this Naphtali Elokim Naphtalti. So Rashi actually struggles with this. What does it mean? And he quotes, I think he quotes his Rebbe, who says that the translation is based on a verse, Tzomid Pasel, which means like this, Chiburim me'eis ha'makom nischabarti imachosim. Okay, the word Naphtali, according to this translation, means Chibur, connection. Okay, it means connection. And it means connection in a very specific context. It means Rachel is saying, I am now connected to Leah. I'm now connected to Leah. Now, I didn't see this. I assume what it means is like this, that Rachel at this point has two children, all right, through Bilhah, via Bilhah. And at what point did she, how many children did Leah have at this point?
So Leah has four, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. She stops having children. Rachel has two via the surrogate, right? Via Bilhah. And then Leah has two via her surrogate, which is Zilpah, which is Gad and Asher. And then the final two are born. And then the final two to Leah, which is Yisachar and Zvulun. And the final two for Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin.
Right, so I'm not even sure what the simple translation is that, and now I am connected with my sister. Somehow, after having these two children from Bilhah, she feels like she now has this connection with her sister Leah. She's like on the same playing field as Leah. I don't know, do you have like a simple explanation for why that is, or?
It's a mystery. I don't know. Because she doesn't say that after the first baby, right?
You're right. So, she doesn't say after the first baby.
If it was just a sign of the fact that she now has a baby, well, that would apply, you would imagine, after one. Only after two does she say, well, now it's Naphtali. Now it's, now I'm on kind of equal footing with my sister. It is strange, this Rashi. Chapter 30, verse 8. Naphtule Elohim Naphtalti. Interesting. I don't know. Okay. I don't know what this means.
Okay. All right. So, but be that as it may. So at this point, we know something very interesting about Naphtali. He has this power to connect Rachel with Leah. However that works, he's the one who represents this, this power, this energy of connecting Rachel with Leah. Now, let's jump right into it. This is critical. This is critical in terms of his relationship, with the month of Adar because the B'nai Yisachar speaks very clearly about the idea of Rachel and Leah coming together to fight Amalek. He says that Rachel and Leah must be working in unity in order to combat Amalek. And he says that that's why when they waged war against Amalek in Parshas Bishalach, it was Moshe Rabbeinu and Yeshua working together. So Moshe Rabbeinu issued the commandment and Yeshua carried it out. Have you ever asked yourself, why is that? Why doesn't Moshe Rabbeinu himself just go to war against Amalek? Why do we need this joint effort? And the B'nai Sasso explains that, no, you need a joint effort. You need to have Rachel and Leah working in tandem. And Moshe comes from, right, he comes from Levi, who's a child of Leah. Yeshua comes from Ephraim, who's a child of Yosef, who's a child of Rachel. So through Moshe and Yeshua working together, you have the combination of Rachel and Leah, which is critical in fighting Amalek. Okay, hold on. Says the B'nai Sasso, Mordechai is Gematria, Rachel, Leah, right? So Mordechai, who goes on to combat Haman, right, who's you know, the progeny of Amalek, he represents this union of Rachel and Leah, you know, and that's hinted to by the numerical value of his name. That's pretty
incredible. Very, very interesting. So you said a lot. Let me just unpack what you said as I understand it. Naphtali, the etymology of his name, Rashi tells us, the word Naphtali means a bind, a connection, a linkage. And Rashi explains that that's the linkage between the two sisters. Leah, she was in her own class. She was the only one who was fertile, and her sister was barren. So there was a misalignment, so to speak, between these two sisters. And Naphtali symbolizes the fusion, the unity of these two sisters. Now you're telling me, based upon the B'nai Sasachar, that the binding, the fusion of Rachel and Leah, of Rachel and Leah, that is the necessary the ingredients. That's the necessary concoction, the recipe for defeating Amalek. And that's why chapter 17 of Exodus, when they wage war against Amalek, it's Moshe, who was the scion of Leah, and Joshua, the scion of Rachel. They must work in tandem. And thus Mordechai, who again fights his version of, or defeats his version of Amalek in his day, the gematria of that word, Mordechai, is Rachel Leah, because he kind of embodies the fusion of the two. And thus, you're telling me that Naphtali, if he, in fact, at his very genesis, at the very beginning of his life, his name, his essence, is symbolizing the fusion of Rachel Leah. It makes sense that he's going to be the one who's going to represent the month of Adar.
Exactly.
And this does, by the way, just to harken back to some of the other subjects you've spoken about in the past, quite eloquently, it does seem to invoke the two messiahs, right? I don't know if that's later on your list, but we have Messiah ben David, Messiah ben Joseph. David's from the tribe of Judah, which is from, of course, Leah. And Messiah ben Joseph, well, that's from Joseph, from Rachel. So you talked about the unity of the two and the two stitched coming together, and both of those being, you know, united in purpose in defeating Esav and defeating Amalek. That is that kind of resembles the same kind of idea.
Well, that's incredible, because I actually did not think of, I'm ashamed to say that I did not think of that. So this is
fine. We can edit it out of the podcast and make it sound like it's.
What did you call yourself at the beginning of the year? The
scaffolding.
The scaffolding, yeah. So apparently you're a lot more than that. Okay, excellent. So now I'm going to wax a little bit Kabbalistic here, because I want to explain what does this mean? This all sounds like way out there. So Rachel and Leah coming together to fight Amalek. Why is that? Right? Why is that? Why do you need that? So I'm not going to explain it on simple terms, although I'm sure you can. Here's what I would like to submit. And that is that Kabbalistically, right, there's the four letter, the ineffable name. Or there will be is a great word for it.
What, the tetragrammaton?
Yeah, I'll never, ever remember that. I have tried to commit it to memory.
Tetragrammaton. Not to be confused with the Decalogue. All these great words. Tetragrammaton. Yeah, it's the four Hebrew letters. Yud Kei Vav Kei. Tetragrammaton. It's a great word.
Tetragrammaton. All right. So there's the four. There's the four letters. Now,
tetragrammaton. Tetragrammaton.
That's the problem when I record here. And I got this. I have my computer open here. I could do all sorts of things.
Tetragrammaton.
All right. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Google.
All right. So Kabbalistically as follows. These four letters represent four worlds, at least four spiritual worlds. Okay. And without getting into the whole subject, the Hays, the letter Hay is always takes on a feminine role. And we know this actually. Right. And this is just basic grammar, right? Hebrew grammar, it will be, right? You know Hebrew a lot better than I do. You lived in Israel for a bunch of years. Whenever you speak, to a woman or about a woman, you add a hey at the end of the word. So hey, it has a feminine role. So there's the yud in the four letter name, which I don't know the English word for. There's this four letter name and there's a yud, there's a hey, there's a vav, there's a hey. So there's these four worlds, which I'm not going to get into the whole subject, but the one takeaway is that the two Hays are both going to have some sort of feminine role. And in the Kabbalistic works, it all refers to the first Hay as Leah and the second Hay as Rachel. Okay. So Hay A is Leah, Hay B is Rachel. And these refer to two worlds. The first Hay being the upper world, what we would call the world of Bina. That's where the Kisei HaKavod is. And then the lower world being the lower Hay, the final Hay being the lower world, which is what we call the Olam Asiya, which is really where we live and where we operate, where the word Asiya means to do, to perform, to accomplish, right? And that's what happens down in this world. So Rachel pertains to this world down here. Leah pertains to the upper world, the world where the Kisei HaKavod exists. The terms Kabbalistically are important to remember this is the upper world is called Bina. Bina, the bottom was called Malchus. So there's Rachel, Leah, Hey, Hey, Bina, Malchus. Let's just remember that. Again, I know this is esoteric stuff, but is this, you know, still something we can work with, Rabbi Wolby?
Listen, it's very Kabbalistic, but I can repeat what you said. You're telling me that Hey is feminine. Yud-Kevavke represents four worlds, which we haven't told us much about them, but okay. And the first Hay is Leah, which is Bina, which is more elevated, more a different transcendental level. And the second Hay, that represents Rachel, and that is called Malchus, and that's kind of our world, Olam Asiya. Okay, these are terminologies that anyone who studies Kabbalah, you've heard these. What they mean, we don't know. We don't profess to know anything about these things. At least I don't. But... let's proceed.
Right. So now what we know about Amalek is, and this is the verse basically tells us, is that Amalek challenges the Kisei HaKavod, or at least the revelation of the Kisei HaKavod in this world, right? At the end, the very tail end of the Parshas B'Shalach, after the battle between Amalek and the Jewish people, the verse says, Hashem says, Tiyad al Kes Ka, Mochama Tiyah and Amalek Midardar, my hand, I think Hashem is saying his hand is upon the throne, and it says the word kisei is missing an aleph, right? It says case instead of kisei. The idea being that Amalek somehow is able to affect or obfuscate the kisei hakavod, right?
Yes. And then Rashi even says that so long as Amalek reigns, the throne of God is incomplete, and therefore it's going to be spelled missing a letter. It won't be kisei, which is a kaf and a samach and an aleph. It's missing. The aleph is omitted because that's, I guess, what Amalek does is they diminish from the throne of God, which you tell me it's in the Bina, it's in the first Hay, it's in the Leah.
Right.
Again, this is all, just to clarify, we're using Kabbalistic lingo. It's all an allegory, right? It's all an allegory.
I mean, it's all our very, very shallow perception. We're like groping around in the dark here, but we do know these to be true. We just don't understand their depth.
Yes.
Now, but the point is like this. Putting all these pieces together, what Amalek effectively does, what their power is to divide Hey A and Hey B, right? Because Hey A, as I mentioned earlier, is the upper world. It's the world where the Kisei HaKavod reigns. And what Amalek has the ability to do is to kind of block it off, to make it that the Kisei HaKavod is not relatable anymore from this world, right? They cause a divide between the upper and the lower worlds, i.e. a divide between the two Hays, a divide between Rachel and Leah.
So, okay, let me just unpack what I think you're saying. when the verse says that a mullet affects the throne of God, and instead of a kisei, it's a case, it's missing a letter, that doesn't mean that it actually affects or influences or impinges upon the throne of God. What it does is it affects our perception of that. Because we're here in this lower sphere, it, to use your word, it obfuscates the throne of God, and thus it makes it appear somewhat diminished in our eyes. And thus you're telling me that a Malek, its role is not, doesn't actually diminish the throne of God, only in our perception, because it severs our connection to it, or it weakens, it damages our connection with the upper spheres, and thereby the kisei in our view is a case.
That's right. But keeping in mind that the upper world is referred to as Leah, and the lower world is referred to as Rachel. So now we understand, we go back to what we discussed earlier, the Ben Yisrael, who tells us that Rachel and Leah must work together to fight Amalek. Now we understand that, because Amalek's entire mission is to divide Rachel from Leah, to divide the lower world from the upper world, right? So you need it. You need to come with an opposing force. You need to come with the strength of the combination, the strength of the union, in order to combat those who are trying to oppose that union, right? So it really makes a lot of sense, this idea that Rachel and Leah have to come together. Understandable?
I love it. Love it.
Okay, so that's really the depth of the idea of Rachel and Leah. And again, mysteriously, Naphtali is the one who really has the power of bringing those two forces together, right? It's all up to Naphtali. So using all of these ideas, I think we can explain why it is absolutely 100% central to Naphtali's role that he is able to race back to Mitzrayim, get the bill of sale, and prove that the cave of the patriarchs, the Ma'aris HaMachpelah, belong to us as opposed to Esau. Now, why is that? The word for the cave of the patriarchs, in the term that the Torah uses, Ma'aras HaMachpelah, the cave of the doubling. The doubling, right? Now, there's two explanations for that in the Talmud. Either that there's all couples that are buried there, Adam and Chava, Avram, Sarah, Yitzchak, Rivka, Yaakov, Leah, right? They're all couples. So that's the coupling going on. The other explanation is that if the cave itself is just the architectural structure of it is double, either there's an upstairs and a downstairs, or there are two rooms next to each other. I think those are two different opinions in the Talmud. The point is, it either has to do with who's buried there or how it's structured. That's the simple understanding. The Zohar takes a very different approach, and that is Ma'aras HaMachpelah. The way you read it is Machpel Hay, the doubling of the Hays, referring to the upper Hay and the lower Hay, the Rachel and the Leah. The Ma'aris HaMachpelah is where those two come together. That's the idea. I don't know if the Zohar says it or the commentary say this, that it's in Chevron. Chevron means chibur, connection. Right? We saw that word in Rashi. Rashi says that when Naphtali is born, she says, chiburim nischabarti. I am now connected with Leah. Right? It's the same root word as Chevron. So the Zohar is telling us that Ma'aris HaMachpelah is the secret of how the two Hays, or at least where the two Hays, come together.
And just to explain what I think you're saying, the word Machpelah, which is, that's the adjective for the word Ma'ara. Ma'ara means a cave. What type of cave? The doubling cave, Machpelah. So does it mean that, there's couples there, or it's laid out as two different sections, it's doubled? But the way the word Machpel means to double, a Machpelah, it's the doubling, and then you add that hey, like you told us that the feminine, right? Any feminine word, you add a hey to it. So you tell me that the Zohar says, Machpel, he kind of tells, the word Machpelah means the doubling of the letter hey, i.e. the first hey, the last hey, the Rachel and the Leah, or the Leah and the Rachel, more precisely.
That's right. So there's one person in the world. So here's like this. Esav challenges that. Now, why is Esav challenged that? Because Esav is the forebear of Amalek. Right? Esav does whatever Amalek would do. So Esav, what he wants to do, you gotta ask yourself a question, like, why does Esav really care about this whole thing? Like, this is his last ditch attempt. He gets killed, like, immediately after, right? This is like his final say in the world, is to try and challenge the Jewish people's right to the Cave of the Patriarchs. Now, according to all this, that has a lot of depth, because that's really Amalek's entire mission statement. Because the Ma'ariv of Bela is the place where these two Hays connect. Esav and Amalek will do anything they can to deny us that connection, because that's what will sever the upper world from the lower world. And that's what Esav is fighting for his life to ensure that we don't get it. You understand? That's why I think the depth of Esav's challenges. Now, who do we send to prove otherwise? Who has the power to prove that it's in our hands? Naphtali. Because Naphtali is the one who connects the two worlds. He connects Rachel with Leah. So it's specifically Naphtali who's able to race back. Now, why he's able to do it so fast, I don't know. But it's basically, maybe it's just this idea that he's so connected to this connection that he's able to do things that nobody can do, just to prove it, to prove that the Ma'ariv HaMechpelah is in our possession, because that's his entire essence. That he is Chevron, right? He's the Chiburim Shenis Chabarti Emachosi. That's Rashi's term. And the Ma'ariv HaMechpelah is in Chevron. He is that. Naphtali, his entire essence is the Ma'ariv HaMechpelah. So he's able to just become superhuman and race back to Mitzrayim and do whatever he needs to do to prove that it's in our possession.
Love it. So you're telling me that Esav, he is the, you know, the archetype, the embodiment of Amalek, and therefore his role is to drive this wedge between the Machpel Hay, the doubling, the unification of the Rachel, the Leah, of the upper spheres and the lower spheres. As we know, by the way, the Midrash says that this location is a portal to the upper spheres, right? This is a touch point of heaven and earth. So it makes sense that this would be a place where it would be a Machpel Hay, a doubling of the Hay, a fusion of the worlds, of the world of Leah, the world of Rachel. So Esav, his essence is to try to stop that, to try to obfuscate the throne, to create that wedge between these two worlds, and therefore that's what he represents, what he does, and therefore Naphtali is sent to go prove otherwise, to bring the documentation that no, this is actually appropriate.
That's right. And what's interesting, and I haven't really worked this through, is that ultimately who is the one who accomplishes it? And that's Hushim ben Dan, and Dan is Naphtali's brother, right? They both come from Bilhah. It's almost as if Dan also is related to this theme.
It could relate to what we mentioned earlier, right? We asked the question, you know, why is Naphtali the one that creates equality between Rachel and Leah? Really, you know, Dan was the one that made Rachel into a matriarch, right? Into a mother via the surrogacy. So maybe there's a little bit of the unification of Rachel and Leah already present in Dan, right? The first son of Bilhah slash Rachel. So maybe you don't need the full dose. You don't need the full dose of unification, even, you know, a half dose. Even Dan, right? Even that will be enough to get rid of this menace.
Right, and something I was thinking, and I actually tried to look into it, I didn't come up with anything, which is the word Bilhah, right, has two Hays in it, right? Bilhah is the mom of both Dan and Naphtali, so those two Hays are in the name Bilhah.
Well, okay, let me add another theory here. Let me add another theory. What happened with Esav? Are you going to like this? His head stayed there. So maybe if Naphtali was the one who did it, there would be nothing left of Esav there trying to blockade there. Oh.
Interesting.
Dan did a half job, so to speak. Mm-hmm. He didn't completely eradicate the influences or the role, so to speak, of Esav in this cave, and therefore Esav's head is still there, you know, creating a slight barrier, so to speak. There's a little bit of his influence still behind. You know, had Naphtali maybe done that, it would have done it completely.
Exactly. I hear that's very, very brilliant. I want to continue, but there's this one idea that I had. It's really wild, and I want to just share it, even though it's a little bit tangential. And that is that there's really, so Hebron is interesting because it's the world, the place of Chibor, where the upper world and the lower world connect. But there's another place in the world that seems to do that even more effectively, and that is the Beis HaMikdash, right? Beis HaMikdash is the place where we connect. And that is definitely true, I think the Sfarim discussed that the Chevron and Yerushalayim are like two flip sides of the same coin. But basically the idea is that we know, it's the same word, right? And the Pasuk in Tehillim says, Ir shechubra, again, that word chibur, la yachdav, that Yerushalayim is the city where there's chibur. And the idea is that there's a Yerushalayim shel mala, there's an upper Yerushalayim shel mata, there's a lower Yerushalayim. And when things are good, as the way it should be, they're aligned with each other. And right now, when there's churban, things are not the way they should be. I did see that Rav Moshe Wilson says the word churban is gematria, is the same letters as Hebron, because when the Yerushalayim isn't working the way it should be, so then you have to shift over to Hebron. But the point here is that Yerushalayim really has the same function of connecting the world of Rachel with the world of Leah. Now, so here's just something wild that I thought of, which is, right, in gematria, sometimes what we do is, instead of just doing the word as you see it, you look at each letter, and each letter could be spelled out, right? So let's say Rabbi Woolley's name is Yaakov. So Yaakov is gematria 182. But what you can do is you could look at the Yud. How do you spell Yud? Yud, Vav, Dalet. Okay, Yud plus Vav, Zal, that would be 20, right? Then the Ayin would be Ayin, Yud, Nun, which would be 130, so on and so forth, right? So it's really the entire expanse of the word. You take the gematria of every component of it. So I did the gematria of Rachel Leah, working with that, right? Spelling out a Reish, spelling out Ches, spelling out Lamed, spelling out Lamed, spelling out Aleph, spelling out Hey. The number I came to was 1193. If you divide that in half, you get Yerushalayim, which is just wild, because there's Yerushalayim Shalmala, there's Yerushalayim Shalmata.
Wait, it's Yerushalayim times two?
It's off by one. So in other words, Yerushalayim times two is 1192. And this Rachel Leah, if you spell out each letter, is 1193. So it's basically like Yerushalayim 0.5, Yerushalayim 0.5, right? They're meeting in the middle. It's really incredible.
Classic.
Yeah. Okay. But that was just a little bit off to the side. The point here is, okay, circling back, we're trying to understand. So there's Naphtali, and Naphtali represents the union of Rachel Leah. The union of Rachel Leah is what overcomes, what ultimately triumphs over Amalek. But now we want to understand why that brings to joy. Because remember, the Targumos of Menuziel said, Naphtali, okay, he's joyful with a fish in the sea. He's joyful with a fish in the sea. So, and other, as we know, brings to joy. So we're going to have to somehow take all of these ideas, lump them together, and show you why this brings to joy. What does it have to do with joy? So I want to read to you, I have it printed in front of me, the words of the Chasam Sofer in his Drashos on Rosh Hashanah. Okay, and here's what he says. He's talking about the idea of doing tshuva. Now, the Sforim tell us the word tshuva is you break down like it's tashuv hay. Tashuv hay, you return the hay.
Tshuva means repentance, right?
Yeah, tshuva means repentance. But on a slightly deeper level, what repentance affects is a tashuv hay, returning of the hay. Now, what does that mean? What that means is like everything we just discussed, that what sin can accomplish, what Amalek accomplishes, what evil, what impurity, what that does is it divides the two hays, right?
The lower hay goes astray.
It goes astray, or again, maybe it just appears to go astray, but the idea is that it's not reflecting the upper hay the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
So tshuva is tashav hay, you bring back the hay, you bring these two hays together. And you make them aligned, and you make one, the idea is that the upper world should shine down directly to the lower world. We should be able to bask in the light of the upper world. And that's what you can accomplish through tshuva. So listen to what he says. He quotes the verse that we say, it's in Tehillim, but we say it in Hallel. We sing it, right? Moshivi akeres abayis im abonim samecha. Alleluia. That's the last pasuk in the first chapter that we recite in Hallel. So he says, Moshivi akeres abayis hainu bechinas Rachel. Okay, so this is a little bit Kabbalistic, but it's actually not. It's very understandable. Akeres habayis refers to Rachel. Im habanim refers to Leah. Now let's explain that. Akeres habayis means the ikar, the primary of the house. The primary of the house. The house refers to the house of Jacob, which is really all of the Jewish people, is the house of Jacob, right? So who is the primary wife of the house of Jacob? Who is like the woman of the home? So that's Rachel, because that's Jacob always wanted to marry Rachel, right? Yaakov wanted to marry Rachel. But who's the Im Habanu? Who's the mother of the children? So at least the majority, the lion's share of the children went to Leah. So there's this like strange dual dynamic going on. There's the woman of the home, which is not the same as the mother of the children, right? The woman of the home is Rachel. The mother of the children is Leah. So the term Akeres Abayis, the Iker, the primary of the home, that's Rachel. Im Habanim is Leah. So says the Chasam Sofer, that what if it means Moshivi? Moshivi means to return, right? Same word as Tshuva, Moshivi. Akeres Abayis, Im Habanim. So the Akeres Abayis, Rachel, should be returned to Leah, to the Im Habanim. Okay? What's the next word of it will be? Moshivi Akeres Abayis, Im Habanim.
Smecha, happy, joy.
You see that?
Wow.
When the Akeres Abayis returns to the Im Habanim, when Rachel returns to Leah, that affects joy, affects Simcha. I will tell you something fascinating. That someone told me this. I don't know this for sure, but someone told me that. The way we sing it is Moshivi Akeres Abayis Im Habanim Simcha. Right? So there's a little pause. Moshivi Akeres Abayis, stop. Im Habanim. So this fellow, he studied in the Yeshiva Rabbeinu Chaim Berlin, which the Rosh Yeshiva for a very long time was Yitzchak Huttner, who was very well versed in Kabbalah. So he used to tell them, don't sing it like that. The way you should sing it is Moshivi Akeres Habayis Im Habanim Samecha Hallelujah, because the idea is you're returning the Rachel, the Akeres Habayis, to the Im Habanim, to Leah. So why would you stop? Don't stop, right? If you stop, you're doing exactly what you shouldn't be doing. You're lining them up with each other, right? You understand? It's an amazing insight. It just goes to show how important it is. Even every little nuance in Judaism is so critical. Even the way you sing it. Anyways, I would ask you to verify this with someone who may have known Rav Huttner better, because I did hear it really third hand, because the fellow I spoke to didn't even study under Rav Huttner himself. He studied under a student. So this may be broken telephone, but it's just an interesting insight either way.
So you're telling me like this, we're going back to Naftali. Naftali is the glue that binds Rachel and Leah, the first hay, the top hay, the upper hay, the lower hay, the foil of Amalek and Esav. And you're telling me, based on this verse in Psalms that we read on the Hallel, the verse tells that whenever there's this Moshivi, this returning of Akeres Habayis, of Rachel, to Im Habanim Smecha, to the mother, to Im Habanim, right, to the mother of the children, then there's Smecha, then there's Simcha, there's joy. This breeds joy. So this would explain, you know, why the month of Adar, the month of Naphtali, is a month of joy, but also the translation that you brought, or the elucidation that you brought of the Targum Yonasan, the translation of Jonathan, that when it tells us that Yom Vidarom Yirasha, it tells us that Naphtali symbolizes joy. And we didn't understand that. Now you're explaining it to me based upon this verse. I love it. Fantastic.
Okay, so we're almost done here, but because remember, so we're trying to understand what the Targum Yonasan is. The Chadi. So we understand Naftali is the combination of Rachel. Now we understand the Chadi, that you're happy because the combination of Rachel, Leah, Im Habanim, Kibshev, Kersabai, Im Habanim, Smecha brings the joy. Now, what's the Nune?
Yama, the
fish of the sea. What in the world do they have to do? Okay. Now, this is, it's a little wild. Again, this is for sure something I don't profess to understand, but I'm going to read this to you. So I found this in the Sefer, Likutei HaGra, right? The Gra is Rabbi Eliyahu, from Vilna, the great Vilna Gaon. So this is not him talking. This is a commentary on his words. I don't recall the name of the commentary, but it's a comment. I would venture to say that it's authoritative. So he says that the word nun. Okay. He's not talking about fish. So again, the word nune means fish. Nune is Aramaic for fish, but the word nun, he's referring to the letter, right? There's a letter nun, and the way you spell it is nun, vav nun, right? Remember earlier we mentioned how every letter you could spell it out. So the letter nun which is one of the letters in the Hebrew alphabet, the way you would spell it out is nun vav nun, which sounds exactly the same word as fish in Aramaic. Fish in Aramaic is nun vav nun. So there's this strange connection between the letter nun and fish, right? Fish are called nun, nune, nun. So he says like this, gimel osios nun, heim yam kol vav. Okay. He says nun, 50 is like this. Nun is gematria 50. If you spell it out, so it's nun, 50, then vav, 6, and then another nun, another 50. So it's 50, 6, 50. Right?
106.
106. So he says that the breakdown should translate as follows. The first nun, hold on. The first nun is gematria, is 50, is gematria kol. Kol mean all is 50, right? Kof lamed is gematria 50. So the first nun is 50. The second vav is just a vav. The third vav is nun vav nun. So the first nun is kol, then just the letter vav. The second nun is 50 gematria yam. Yam is ocean. Okay, is also gematria 50. So basically nun vav nun, we should interpret that as kol v'yam, all and ocean. Okay, I know this is a little confusing, but basically kol is gematria 50, yam is gematria 50.
I'll explain it.
Okay.
20 and 30 makes 50, as does 40 and 10. And thus, 50 of the first nun is 20 and 30, kol, and 50 of the last nun is yud mem, 10 and 40.
And the vav always connects.
The vav is the connection, and. Yes. So all and ocean, or and sea.
Now let me read to you, and again, I don't understand, but this is what he said. He says, kol, the word kol is bina. Remember, bina is a word we used before. Bina is the upper world.
Leo.
Yam is malchus, which is the lower world. And with that, he wants to explain the verse of kol ha-necholim, how do you say it? Kol ha-necholim, holchim el hayam. Okay. And he says, vav connects the two. Okay, the idea is like this. The word nun is nun vav nun, is kol v'yam, is bina v'malchus, is a connection between bina and malchus.
So nun is Naphtali, basically.
Oh, yeah, basically. But again, Rabbi Wolbe, you're much better at explaining. So just explain this in your eloquent way of doing things.
The letter nun is spelled, if you were to spell like just the word, like, I made a joke on the podcast once. I said, like, you know, like a letters in the English alphabet, like the letter Z. Z-E-D. That's how you would spell it, right? And it's especially fitting for the Canadians amongst us.
Yes.
Sorry, Shmuley. No one's perfect.
I'm ashamed to say I'm Canadian after Trudeau pulled back on the weapons.
We know nothing about politics, of course, but... So the letter nun is spelled nun vav nun, which is kol, which is bina, which is lea, which is the upper sphere, which is the first hey. Ve, and the malchus, which is the lower spheres, which is the sphere of Rachel, and the second hey. Now this letter nun symbolizes the fusion of the two.
The fusion exactly. Of the two. And again, the word fish, which in Aramaic is nun, you might say, whoa, that's a stretch. Taking the letter nun and you're connecting it to fish, because fish in Aramaic is nun. I've seen this connected. This is not me. I've seen a very authoritative source which says that fish are connected to the letter nun because fish are called nun in Aramaic, and so they're obviously connected to the letter nun. So fish clearly, and again, I have no idea how or why, maybe that'll be the subject of another share, but somehow fish carry within them the fusion of Rachel and Leah, which thus would carry a special happiness, a joy. Because when Rachel and Leah come together, there's joy. And thus, they're directly associated with Naphtali. Naphtali is the one who creates this connection between Rachel and Leah. And now we can understand why Naphtali is the mother of Adar, because Adar is the connection between Rachel and Leah, which combats Amalek, resulting in this joy.
But what does that have to do with fish?
What fish?
Like, why would fish symbolize?
Well, why fish? I have no idea. We got to think about that. Why fish? Well, I do have a whole thing about fish. If you want, I can burden you with it. And that is, I believe that fish are somehow connected with joy, even without all of this. And that's because as follows.
There's no Ayin Hara for fish, right?
So there's no Ayin Hara for fish. Which, by the way, I have this whole theory that the Ayin Hara plays a big role in this, because the Ma'arsa Machpela, right, originally was owned by Ephron. Ephron, the manager says, he loses a vav. It starts with Ephron, it's spelled Ayin Fei Reish Vav Nun. Then it switches to Ayin Fei Reish Nun, says the Medrash, because he had an Ayin Ra. He had a Ra, Ayin Ra. And the commentator explained, Ayin Ra is Gematria Ephron, without a vav, right? Ayin Fei is going to be 150. Then Reish makes it 350. Then Nun makes it 400, which is Gematria Ayin Ra. So the Ayin Ra challenges the Ma'arsa Machpela. And then Lavan, I have a whole theory about that, was also trying to challenge Rachel and Leah, with Ayin Hara. Anyways, but leaving that to the side, right? So fish are exempt from Ayin Hara. But this was my idea, that I think that fish have a connection with happiness. And here's why. Because the source of, what's the opposite of happiness?
Sadness,
depression. Right? The word for that in English, in Hebrew, is etzev. Now, there's really, in the Torah, the term etzev does not come up a lot. But the first two times are actually back to back, two psukim next to each other, after the sin of the Eitz Hadas. So Chava receives the curse of the Etzev Tel Dibanim, right? The Etzev, with some sort of like depression, children will be born. And then Adam receives a curse to the Adama. I don't remember the exact term, but it's, the Adama will be Be'itzavon or something like that, that there will be some sort of, it's hard to say that the land will be depressed. But obviously it just means like it will be weighed down. It won't produce the way it was supposed to produce. The idea here is that fish seem to be exempt from both of them, because fish, right, we get the blessing of the Yud Gulero of the Kavards. You should have children like the fish have children. The fish like represent the apex of productivity. They're just able to have children much faster and much more plentiful than we are. The point might be that they are not included in the curse of Etzev Tel Dibanim, and obviously the curse to the land doesn't affect them at all because they don't live on the land. So I have this theory that the curses of Etzev don't apply to fish. And another proof to that is that another time we see the word Etzev is later, right before the flood. Hashem said, "Vayis'atzev alibo." Hashem, hard to say, he was depressed. I don't know what that means exactly, but I guess he wanted to wipe out all of humanity,
but not
because
the fish.
Of this Itzavon. Of own. And again, he did not wipe out the fish.
And I just saw this week, coincidentally, that the Midrash says that Adam and Eve gave from the fruit to be eaten by all the animals, with the exception of the fish.
Oh, that's perfect.
It's a Midrash. So therefore, all of the animals, not just the humans, they all participate in the sin of Adam and Eve, and thus they are somewhat culpable on some level, and therefore the curse will be applied to them on some level. But that's why, when it comes to the punishment, the fish are exempt, and the manifestation of the punishment that happens a few generations later with the flood, they were also exempt as well.
Well, so then once you tell me that, so then everything's really, really very understandable, because the sin of the Eitz, that right, Haman is hinted to in the Torah from the words Hamin Ha'Eitz, right? The Gemara says, where is Haman hinted to? Hamin Ha'Eitz. Haman is, he's the Eitz Hadas. He comes from the place of the Eitz Hadas. Amalek comes from the place of the Eitz Hadas. So the whole source of this idea, this ability to divide the upper world from the lower world, it really is sourced. I mean, I was saying how Amalek challenges, it's really all coming from the Eitz Hadas. Right? I mean, Adam and Chava got tossed out of Gan Eden the moment they ate from the Eitz Hadas, this idea being that they lost the ability to associate with the upper world. So it all comes from the Eitz Hadas. So if fish were exempt from the Eitz Hadas, so then it makes a lot of sense that they maintain that connection with the upper world, right? They weren't thrown out the way we were.
I like it. And I'll also tell you just another point to wrap this up. If Nun symbolizes the fusion, the Naphtali, the reversal of the sin of Adam, the joy that comes from the unification of Akeres HaBayis and Eimo Banim, the Smecha. It makes sense that, let's say, the sign of revelations on the 50th day, right? That's day 50, because that's when the heaven and earth were united. And we're supposed to study Torah, Smechem Kinesinasa Messinai, right?
Oh, wow. Okay, I got that. Smechem Kinesinasa
Messinai. Right.
Okay,
there was an unparalleled joy that was present at Sinai because that was that 50, that the ultimate Naftali, so to speak, the unification of heaven and earth. And I would say, it seems like to me that maybe Yovel, the year 50, and the 50th Shari Bina, that elusive 50th level of insight that we hope to one day reclaim, that is all symbolized by this idea of this fusion, this merging, this restoration of the unity of the two worlds.
Beautiful.
An absolute masterpiece, courtesy of Rabbi Botnick. This was wonderful. Do you think it's fitting to mention that the Torch fundraiser is still happening at givetorch.org? Is that appropriate to mention?
I think so.
You think
because
so?
Because through that, we can have more shiurim like this.
Give some donation in honor of Rabbi Botnick so we can have... will you agree that if someone makes a donation in your honor, that you'll do another
podcast? It would have to be Gamashi unknown, so at the minimum would be 106. ideally, Rachelea, which is 274.
Didn't you tell me that Jerusalem is 1190-something?
Oh, right.
Rachel and Leah, when it's doubled, you said it was, what was it,
1193?
And that's Jerusalem times two. We'll take it. GiveTorch.org. Links in the description. Okay, I have to do that just contractually. Anytime I speak during the 2 weeks of the fundraiser, I'm bound to do that. But this was wonderful. This was a masterpiece. It's great to have you back. It's nice that we get a celebrity like you to come join our humble podcast. Thank you so much.
We'll have something for Nissan. Nissan's a big month.
Well, and hopefully we'll merit to be able to see this unification, right? We Amalek is still amongst us, and the idea of Messiah is the final triumph over Amalek, and that's the ultimate. You know, when Naftali finally comes back with the evidence, right? we're waiting still. We're waiting, and he's an Ayala Shlucha. He's still being sent. You know, we're still waiting for him to come back.
Well, that's great. That's a very nice idea. He never came back, really. What that means? We're waiting for the
return of Naftali. Thank you so much, Rabbi Botnick. If you want to send Rabbi Botnick an email, it's botnicksm@gmail.com. Spam him with all your requests. Bother him with all your requests. Botnick, BOTNICK, bot like a robot, Nick like a Nickelodeon, sm@gmail.com. My email address is rabbiwolby@gmail.com. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful Purim, everyone. And please, God, we'll have Rabbi Botnick back for a Pesach bonanza, a Pesach special. Please, God, he's working on it as we speak. Thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
Okay, thank you so much, everyone.
Okay, take care.